I think all 40,000 passed by where we were standing at mile 4, Dick, over.
I think I heard on the news 42,000. I know that in past years the total number of engines was slightly greater than the number announced. I think there was something like 42,000. That's a lot of humanity running by. I wonder, by mile marker 4, probably you don't need as much first aid. By mile marker 20, we were right in front of the Metropolitan Hospital, and a significant number of people dropped out, at least for a period of time, to let muscles relax or stop jamming up and things like this. So I presume your mile marker 4 was a watering station, a communication station, and a rather small number of people dropped out at that time. Is that true? Back to you, Mel.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, this is K2KEY. I'm laughing only because of this book. I keep reading on. One of the requirements also for a metering, let me just say this, a metering employee is physical strength, because you may be subject to removing ice loading from wiring. Oh my God, this is so funny. I mean, now you laugh about it, how serious they took things back in those days. The only one we had, in fact, we only had one problem there, right opposite where I was. They had a first aid station, and one young lady twisted her ankle and required, she twisted pretty bad, it started to swell up, and they were applying ice to it and all, but they called for an ambulance just to take it to a local hospital, I guess, to have it x-rayed over.
She had one dropout. What was the later weather like? And describe some of the unusual engines that you saw, Mel, other than the Achilles people. Go ahead.
The Achilles people, I could say, were quite imaginable with the imagination they had come up with to be able to do these things. I mean, people running literally on these flexible springs, it looked like, and others with wheelchairs that they're pushing them backwards. And, of course, the ones that have these vehicles that are hand-propelled, that was, I mean, the Achilles group. The people, some were running in costumes, some strange-looking costumes. There was the green man. He was he was wearing these tights, looked like his underwear, all like, you know, long johns, all in green. And then there was a couple of, I guess they were in the show business or whatever, you know, people of music or whatever. Everybody was, young people were all applauding them and looking, you know, and looking particularly at certain people there. I guess they most likely were celebrities of some sort, take over.
Yeah, each one of the major broadcast stations will have a couple of their news broadcasters or weather people who are recognizable celebrities, personalities, and I imagine some of the crowd will cheer them on when they recognize them. What other unusual costumes, and what was the later weather like, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, I can't help it. I'm reading this book, Dick, and I'm dying from this. Yeah. One of the requirements also is do not have a proclivity for alcohol, because this could endanger you and your you and other employees. Over.
Okay, that makes some sense. At the marathon, what was the weather like, and what were some of the other strange costumes? Over to you, Mel.
I'll close this book before. What was the weather like? Well, when I was leaving in the morning at around 6-ish, it was raining just lightly, and it was still dark. And by the time I got there, the rain had let up, the drizzle had let up, but it was very damp the whole day. It was just very uncomfortable, because it was that damp wind that sort of... not that the temperature was, you know, too bad, because it was up in the 50s, upper 50s, but the wind was blowing this sort of dampness, like almost like a very fine rain, Dick, over.
So it never did warm up, and I guess you're saying the very fine mist never disappeared, and the wind continued throughout most of the day. Any other really wild costumes and crazy people?
Let me think. Well, I'm telling you, a lot of people use their imagination and all. There was 100 countries, you remember, represented, so many of them were in colors of their flag of their country and marked on their Denmark, I saw, and I saw Italians. A lot of Italians came in, seemed for it, that they're all marked with Italia. And then I saw a number of them from the UK running together. And, oh, there were two guys that were running in completely in tuxedos.
Oh.
And they they were supposedly, I guess, waiters, because they were sort of carrying mock plates with, like, a bottle that was, I guess, glued to it. Looked like they were maybe from some hotel or something or whatever, I don't know, some restaurant. And most likely it was a challenge race. And, of course, there was the police department and the fire department groups running in together in their race every year. They have a New York's finest, you know, versus New York's bravest, Dick, over.
Yep, I remember seeing all of those in the past. You probably don't see it as much on 4th Avenue, but on 1st Avenue in Manhattan, there were a number of groups supplying electronic music. And as I may have described to you once before, I remember this flatbed trailer truck with loudspeakers that were about 10 foot high, fed with thousands of watts of audio. In some cases, they were playing recorded music, but in some cases, they were creating live music. And how the hearing of those guys can survive, I'll never know. I remember walking up the block, 400 yards away, and the music was so loud, I could feel it as a vibration through the street. Now back to you, Mel, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. All right, last thing I'm reading in this book. As an Edison employee, you have the right to refuse service to any customer where you think they will provide a hazard for their wiring. How do you like that? So, boy, oh boy, to be a meter man in those days, Dick, boy, you have to be something. I'm telling you, this is too much. That's all. Closing the book. Anyhow, it was quite an event, Golden Dick, but the turnout this year was really phenomenal. Over.
Yeah, it's going to increase every year. Was there someone else who wanted to make a comment or a question? Go right ahead.
Yeah, Dick, it's Bernie, KTYO. I was commenting, you were saying about the how did they not go deaf. Most rock stars in the 70s and 80s, if the drugs and alcohol didn't kill them, they are profoundly deaf nowadays. There's a Pete Townsend from the Who has done a number of PSAs about trying to get people to turn the music down or use hearing protection. There's actually companies that make high-end headsets and hearing protection that are chronically flat across the frequency range, so you can hear in the concert, you still get the pleasure of the music, but not 20 or 30 decibels off.
Who is that?
WL2Z, play check-in with a question.
Go right ahead. Start off with your name.
Hi, Dick, and everyone on the net. Name is Ian. Call sign is Whiskey Ocean 2 Zulu. Just a quick question, Dick. The other day I picked up a 432 Motorola 4CX250B, one of those old amplifiers I guess they used in repeaters. I was wondering if there might be some source in libraries or somewhere else that might have like wiring diagrams, so forth for that type of equipment.
Without a doubt, the answer is yes. You're about to ask now which one. Motorola equipment, like the one you're describing, was extremely popular at one time. So there's got to be a website, there's got to be a technical library that's got that data. And now, how do you get a hold of those particular folks that have got the data? That's a darn good question. I don't know what to suggest. wonder if you've got a suggestion, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
WB2HWW.
Okay, Howie's got some information. Go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, just call up one of the local radio shops. I can't say names, but call up a shop in Long Island City and just speak to one of the hams there, and they probably can just give you a copy of the schematic, or go on, well, just do a Google search. You'll find it on Google. But if you go to one of the local shops and you ask Andy, I'll bet you CDL has it, Dick.
That's a good suggestion. Andy, WA2CDL, who has worked for a number of years for Motorola dealers and Motorola repair shops. If he doesn't have it himself, he probably knows who does. And Andy is the guy who runs the tune-up clinic for radios at this repeater group on their two or three or four get-togethers per year. And he's on this machine almost every single day at some time. So, Ian, that looks like a good lead from my point of view. You got it, Ian. K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I appreciate it. And the other station, I appreciate it. I shall try to reach him, give him a call or something. Yeah, I tried online Google searches for Micor, Motorola, 250, and where a lot of articles, including references to your design several years back in the 70s. Nothing really came up for those particular units that I was looking for, so thanks for the suggestion. And the only weird thing about one of the amps that I had, which was a 432 using the two 4CX 250s, were that each tube is being fed, the plate is being fed by an individual high voltage line. Everything else looks like your standard connections and wiring. So that was a little strange there. But I will try Andy, and hopefully he has something that will give me some ideas. I'll clear with the net. Whiskey Ocean 2 Zulu will be clear.
What's the pull for the station, Dick?
Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, the schematic for a lot of that stuff can be found at repeaterbuilder.com. They don't have everything, but there's a good selection of stuff. Micors, masters, amplifiers, stuff like that. You have to look. There's a big library of schematics.
Okay, repeaterbuilder.com. That's a goodie. And Howie, did you want to say something else?
Well, to get it running in sideband or FM, because that's probably running Class C.
It's going to be biased to sideband.
Okay, so you're going to have to rebuild that whole thing. Okay, that's a Class C amplifier. Those are Class C.
I don't have the power supply, so that was another thing, which I was going to go with, big design, which is pretty straightforward, but what threw me was the two individual lines for each tube.
My design has only one line for two tubes. Go ahead.
Correct.
And that strip line design was built with hand tools in the bedroom of the apartment I was living in at the time. So it doesn't require a fancy machine shop. And that's an approach. So well, it sounds like you're going to be on 432 one of these days soon. And by the way, to take a Class C amplifier and run it Class Linear is primarily readjusting of the control grid bias and a little bit of change in the output impedance of the final tank circuit. It's not a very big deal. Yes, to establish the new bias voltages on somebody's fixed design, that could be a big deal. But as far as what you're really doing, you're just taking the control grid voltage and essentially lowering it so that there's a certain amount of standby plate current. I'm also guessing that you got two separate power wires going to the plate voltage terminals of the tubes so that you have the ability to measure the individual plate currents. You could have done it also by measuring the individual cathode currents, because within 98% they're the same thing. But that could be what's going on. Any further questions or comments, Ian? K2 KQLIW.
Yeah, just one last question, Dick. I see there was, and this was way back in the 70s, there was a group up in upstate New York somewhere in Greenbush. It was called ARCOS, A-R-C-O-S, and they sold a kit for power supplies that was pretty much designed to run a pair of Ford CX-250s. I was wondering if anybody might know if that group is, you know, still around or knows anything about it.
That was Mr. Fred Merry, Whiskey 2 Golf November, W2GN. He ran the company called ARCOS, Amateur Radio Component Service, and he became a silent key 15 or 20 years ago. The only person now manufacturing equipment like what you're describing is K1FO, K1 Far Out. Steve Polishin. I'm having trouble remembering the name of his company. A little bit pricey, but he makes an extremely high-quality product. Can someone tell me Steve Polishin's company name, K2LIW? If you just Google K1FO, Steve Polishin, you'll eventually get to his company. In Madison, Connecticut, the company is run from his home. And for the guys who now want to run high-power moon-bounce work on 432 and want to buy amplifiers and power supplies, either fully built up or in kit form, he's one of the last guys that are still doing it. And as I said, makes a very high-quality product. K1, Foxtrot, Oscar, Steve Polishin, Madison, Connecticut. Need any fill on that, Ian? K2RIW?
I appreciate it again, Dick. No, I wrote it down. And yeah, the only thing I guess I was looking for was the transformer that had, you know, the high voltage. And then the second one for, the three voltages you need, the filament, high voltage, and which most of the circuits I see use some form of doubling, and the one for the BIOS. So I'll check his site, and I'll check the other site that was given.
Yeah, you need a separate power supply for the screen grid, or at least a separate regulator. You do want to make sure you continuously monitor screen grid current, because it really tells you what's going on inside that tube, whether or not it's in resonance, and overloaded, underloaded, whatever. Make sure there is no possibility of running the amplifier with screen voltage present without the plate voltage. That can burn up the screen very rapidly. So the screen voltage must not be on unless the plate is on with high voltage. That's your major protection characteristic. Because you exceed 12 volts of screen grid dissipation, the screen will burn up in a couple of seconds. It's got very little thermal mass to it. And a beautiful set of 4CX250Bs will go down the tubes. Guys do that protection by one of two techniques. My technique is to have a series resistor between the screen grid and the power supply. So if the screen grid draws excessive current, the voltage on the screen drops so fast that the dissipation can never exceed 12 watts. That's my method of protection. Simple series resistor with a bypass capacitor at the screen to hold the voltage long enough for the peaks of sideband power, but doesn't allow it to be sustained for more than a fraction of a second or two. The only other technique that guys will use is some kind of a sensing circuit on screen grid current that when a certain current level is exceeded, it turns off the voltage to the screen grid or puts on more bias voltage on the control grid to cut off the tube, does something to stop the emission, or at least the power absorption and dissipation by the screen. I prefer the resistor technique because it's foolproof, whereas the sensing technique with a relay, there's modes by which that can fail and, again, burn up a set of tubes. As long as you protect that screen grid of the tube, and as long as there's enough air moving through that anode, by way of a parallel air cooling arrangement or whatever. Under those conditions, the tube is extremely rugged. Even though the tube is rated for 250 watts of plate dissipation, if you're moving enough air through that tube for short periods of time, you could dissipate 500 watts in each individual tube. and it would not create any damage. So, except for the screen grid, those tubes are very rugged. Back to you, Ian, for any fills, K2RIW.
Definitely keep that in mind. I actually had bought one of those Tetrode control boards from one of the companies in Europe, in the UK. Never built it because I originally bought it to put it on a 4CX1000 amplifier that I had. Never got around to it. So. But I think if I ever get this 250 up and running, we'll keep it simple for starters, and if I get it going, and maybe I'll put that board online.
Yeah, some of this information is in the original article, which was the April and May issue of QST Magazine, 1972. The April issue tells you about the amplifier, and the May issue describes the power supply. And some of these protection techniques and whatever information about the 4CX250B and the right way to feed it is in that article, April and May issue, QST. You can get it from QST archives if you're a ARRL member, or if you've got a friend that's a member. And from time to time, there are websites that will repeat that article. Okay, back to Mel. And maybe Mel's got a chance to see his email list by now. And we've only got 35 minutes left. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Yes, your idea of taking the plate ball and putting it through a bleeder resistor and then tapping off for your screen. And what they usually did was add a, those days, VR tube, voltage regulator tube to keep it stable. I don't know if that's... I'll tell you, there's a very good book that's out by the ARRL called RF Amplifiers, Dick. Have you ever perused through that book, over?
I don't think I have. And I guess you're saying the RF Amplifier book specializes in moon bounce level power of amplifiers. Go ahead.
They have the conventional amplifiers that you want to, you know, still build with tubes, and also solid-state amplifiers. They cover a good number of RF amplifier circuits and power supplies of all different types, whether they be the low voltage, high current, or the old-fashioned high voltage, low current systems. That's where they, of course, divide them off. But occasionally you see at, you know, ham fests, you see some of those old power supplies around. And like I say, they were really nicely designed because they had that bleeder resistance in there and the tap off for the screen, and with a voltage regulator tubes. I think the popular tubes, they put a series of like OA2s or OB2s in there as voltage regulator, if I remember, Dick, over.
Yeah, nowadays you could do that a lot more easily and more compact with Zener diodes, heat synchronized Zener diodes, and the right combination of those giving you something like 350, 375 volts on the screen. As you go closer to 400 or volts or so on that screen, that tube really comes alive and starts giving you gain and power output. The main function that gives you the gain and the power output of that tube is the screen grid voltage. Lower the screen grid voltage and the tube is good for very little power output. Raise the screen grid voltage, and that tube really comes alive. And so not too many people have realized that. Many people will build the amplifier with only 300 volts on the screen and complain that they can't get the power output that they anticipated. By simply raising the screen voltage, you'll be amazed what happens. The peak current capability of the tube is a function of the screen grid voltage to the 3/2 power. So whatever voltage you put on the screen, to raise it exponentially to the 1.5 power, and that gives you the power output of the tube. So about a 50% increase in screen voltage, if I got the mathematics right, probably doubles the power output of the tube. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Great tube. I like them. I have a number of amplifiers that I put together using those tubes, the 4CX 250 series. And of course, I still see them occasionally at ham fest, though very reasonably priced in many cases. And the only thing is, of course, good airflow. That's the problem. A lot of people just want a little blower. They think they're going to stick a little muffin blower in there, and that's going to be sufficient. The old squirrel cage blower is a good way to go with any of those type of tubes, I think, Dick, overall.
Yeah, absolutely. You only need something like 15 cubic feet per minute, or I forget what the exact number was, to go through those tubes. And you pick up a small muffin fan, and it's rated 100 cubic feet per minute. You say, boy, that's a lot more than I need. Uh-huh. It's back pressure. I forget what the exact number is. Something like 0.15 inches of back pressure water, 0.15 inches of water, which you can measure with a manometer, you know, a simple piece of tubing with water in it will allow you to measure back pressure. It's the back pressure the tubes create that slows down the airflow. Therefore, a centrifugal blower, a squirrel cage type blower, can give you the back pressure. And a muffin fan, per se, cannot do that. Oh, I guess a crafty guy could cascade two or three muffin fans together if you could buy them with counter-rotating propellers. To spin them all in the same direction wouldn't do it. But the right way to do it is with a squirrel cage blower. A squirrel cage blower big enough to give you the right airflow is a little bit noisy. I got around that problem by putting the squirrel cage blower in a box with a filter on one side of the box, so it sucks in air through the filter. And I put that in the basement, put a hole in the floor with a piece of heater duct hose coming up through the whole floor that goes to the amplifier. That way I could hear the sound of the air rushing through the tubes, but I didn't have to put up with the sound of the blower. And I think at a later time, I put the blower in a soundproof box and put the blower in the same room with me. But a blower with enough back pressure capability is a bit noisy. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. Yeah, that's right. Collins has it in their power supply. It's down in the bottom, and the power supply is separate. And they duct it up through a pipe that comes out of the back of the power supply into the back of the amplifier head. And no, it's not too noisy because they put a lot of sound-absorbing material inside the power supply. You know, it's acoustic material. So it's not too bad. I have, a couple of those amplifiers. The only thing let me see, what else? I was going to ask you one time. Did you ever see one, somebody told me, went out, that they came out with a version of that amplifier and they used water cooling? Is that possible, Dick? Over.
Absolutely. First of all, you can buy a version of the 4CX250B tube, which is conduction cooled. That's one approach. And many of the tubes of the 2C39 series have a zillion different ways you can water cool those. So if you can water cool a 2C39, and if you're enthusiastic enough in the way you construct the jacket around the tube, there's nothing stopping you from water cooling a 4CX250B. That's the good news. The bad news is now the water that's going through the tube, that's cooling it, that water is sitting up at 2,000 volts above ground. Therefore, you've got to have very low ionic content water to stand off the 2,000 volts, because somewhere else in your system, where you're circulating the water is going through a radiator that's probably grounded. Oh, I guess you could run the whole air exchanger and water cooling system up at 2,000 volts, but I wouldn't recommend it. And I guess the other approach is you could ground the plate of the tube and run the cathode 2,000 volts negative, if you're really crafty. So one way or the other, water cooling does have a high voltage problem and a potential shocking problem if you don't do it just right. Now, the guys who do it with water cooling and a grounded condenser coil, heat exchanger coil, have to periodically change the water to make sure its conductivity is low enough so that the leakage current flowing through the water and its ionic content is not creating a whole lot of extra power dissipation. So when you put it all together, air cooling is a lot more convenient. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Jerry, yeah, no, I have to see it one time. I think they use the water as it comes out of the tube hot. It goes into a fish tank. I remember seeing that. I'm trying to recall where I saw it. In other words, the fish tank, they take the water out of the bottom of the fish tank through a flexible line, a plastic line, go into the amplifier and then the hot water. They had a little circulating pump, I believe, like from a fish tank type of setup. And that the, in other words, the reservoir of the fish tank, a few gallons of water, being circulated through would be sufficient, you know, that circulating to keep the tube cool. So, I don't know. I don't remember where that article was, but it was like an answer to a situation where, you know, with venting and everything to, you know, giving good airflow was a problem. So, I thought possibly you recalled it, Dick, over.
No, I didn't, but I went through the calculations once of how fast you would boil away water. There's nothing stopping you from having a tank of water supplying water to the tubes and let natural convection be the flow mechanism. And if the water boils a little bit around the tubes, that's not bad. I think I've calculated a couple of quarts of water. For how many hours would it take to boil away that water with the dissipation of the tubes with normal duty factor at which you use the tubes? And I think you could run the whole darn contest in a gallon of water. Back to you, Mel. K2LIW.
Good idea. Possibility of a water cooling system. I can say most of all the amplifiers you've seen the last number of years using the ceramic tubes, the so-called type of design tube, I think. Yeah, I guess the 4CX 250 or that line of tubes. So I know they had a 150. I forgot of how many they had, you know, versions of it. And I wound up with the last amplifiers that I built. I wound up with the 3CX 800 series, which, of course, are beautiful tubes. A bit on the pricey side compared to the 4CX series. The 800, so set you back usually a pair of them, I guess, at least more than, well, let's put it this way, at least your week's pay, Dick, over.
Yeah, the Steve Polish and K1FO with his Steppens amplifiers was the brand name he had in the beginning, and later on he converted to another name. He favors the 3CX 800 series of tubes, a triode tube, which gives with the grounded grid service quite a bit more linearity, and he really likes high fidelity linearity. And I think a pair of those tubes are probably what's your guess, $1,200 or so. Mel, go ahead.
Depends on which ones you buy. I know they had a lot of these ones that were coming in from Russia, the Svetlana versions, and they had let's see, the Zymac, of course, the Eichel McCullough, which became now, what is it, Varian, and then there's, there's another company or somebody that's producing them now, of course, because I guess the original patent that was iMac had on them most likely ran out some years ago. So I don't know exactly, you know, what the price is, but I guess they could run quite costly, $400-$500 a tube or something in that neighborhood would not surprise me. But what they did, they offered years ago, when they first came out with it, when the first 3CX800 was introduced, they had an advertisement, and I think it was QST, that as they encouraged hams to build amplifiers with them, iMac at the time was offering that if you bought one tube with the socket and chimney, they would give you the second tube for half price, and that's when I purchased it, Dick, over.
Very nice. And what band did you intend to put that tube on, Mel? Go ahead.
One of my HF amplifiers. I got two of them. I got two HF amplifiers running those tubes. When I wanted another set, I used somebody else's name because it was only one to a ham customer, you know, type of thing. You can only apply for that one time. So I went ahead and I used somebody else's name or got the tubes anyhow. And they're in them. Gee, they're old. They've gone back, they must be 25 years, maybe more. And I guess, you know, I don't push the heck out of them. Don't want to squeeze every last watt out of them. And so they work great. Give you, you know, maximum the full legal output. And that's all. And they, like I say, they are just very, very nice tubes to work with, Dick. Over.
I believe you. Now, the socket that that tube plugs into, is that socket made in those days by iMac or Johnson? I'm guessing Johnson may have made the socket. I'm guessing the socket gives you contact to the filament, cathode, and control grid. And you have to come up with your own arrangement to make contact to the anode. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Nicely. In fact, they laid that socket out very nice with the, you know, for the bypass capacitors and everything. Okay. Very well engineered, that socket. I don't know who made the socket. iMac was selling the socket and the chimney for it. Now, for the contact ring for the plate foliage, they supplied you with this finger stock, a silver-plated finger stock, looked like. It was a band, and it had, like, little fingers, little spring fingers. For and you put it around the tube, and it had, like, a little clamp on the end, which you tightened it up, and had a terminal there for to connect it to the RF choke, Dick. Very, very nicely laid out, and the chimney that they gave you was a nice piece of glass, you know, Pyrex glass, over.
A little bit surprised it wasn't steatite ceramic. Okay, Pyrex glass. The glass becomes a little bit lossy at 432. That's the main reason why a 4X150 and a 4X250 are the exact same tube. The 4X150 has got glass, and it's good for full power output up to 150 megacycles. The 4CX250 has got ceramic in the insulated area around the anode, and that's what brings it up to 500 megacycles for full power output ratings. And if you ran a 4X150 at full power output at 432, it would overheat the glass and it sucks in and melts and you lose the vacuum. That finger stock is what they use to mount the tube, the anode, into a strip line plate resonator. And that's what I did with the parallel kilowatt amplifier. Wonder if you've ever seen one of those strip line parallel kilowatt amplifiers, either as a picture or up close, Mel. Go ahead. K2RIW.
Oh, I built one. I copied your, you know, it's funny. Your design originally, I liked it very much, except for a couple of things that I never understood why you did certain things. But okay, there was another one that came out. Did you notice somebody almost copied that design exactly? And I think, were they selling it commercially with the modification stick? Were you aware of that, over?
Yes, I think so. First of all, Fred Mary, W2 Golf November, up in Greenbush, New York. He was the president of the Arcos company, Amateur Radio Component Service. He was selling almost the identical amplifier. Steve Polishin was making a modified version. I've heard tell from time to time that in Italy somebody was building a version. The Steve Polishin version has got a nice low-pass filter, getting rid of more decibels of attenuation of the higher harmonics, which don't fail FCC specs, but he thought it was a requirement. And you're allowed to tell me what thing that you're not sure why I did it that way, and go right ahead and ask me those questions right now, Mel. K2RIW.
It's something to do with the plate, that copper plate in there. Something I remember. What did I do different about that copper plate, that flapper plate that you had in there? I didn't go for that. And the material you used, something. I know you specified some material, some kind of copper and all, which I could never understand why you used that in there, because I didn't follow that exactly, Dick. Over.
Okay, the actual tuning flapper capacitor, which I think is called C3, but I'm not sure now, C1 or C3, but the tuning capacitor on the anode plate strip line resonator was beryllium copper grounded to the chassis. there was a missing dimension in the schematic in QST magazine, which didn't properly tell you that that has to be mounted below center on the chassis. You have to mount that whole 3/4 of an inch or an inch below center. If you made the mistake of mounting that to the chassis wall, right at the same level as the anode, then you would end up bending it so darn much to keep it to get the right capacitance that the tip of it would be touching ground. And when the tip of that flapper capacitor touches ground, you get a sudden jump in tuning. You don't want that to happen, particularly if it arcs through the string. There was a wind-up string on a shaft that would tune that, and that gives you a nice, fine vernier control, and it gives you a variable capacitor that can tolerate the 39 RF amperes that flows through it. 39 amperes of RF current flows through that flapper capacitor, and it's about 3 inches wide and has no trouble conducting that current to ground. What people had been doing up till that time is building a flapper capacitor, a tuning capacitor, out of some kind of a disc that was on a threaded rod. And the 39 amperes flowing through the last turn of the threaded rod would weld it to the wall, if you know what I mean. A very unreliable tuning mechanism. The loading control was also another flapper capacitor going over to the center conductor of the output type N connector. And it also had to be mounted below center. But that dimension was omitted from the diagram in the manual in the QST magazine. So people ran into trouble with too much capacitance on the loading flapper capacitor and too much capacitance on the tuning capacitor because of mounting both of them too high. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I don't remember. I know I didn't go for certain things that you did there. I think it was the flapper capacitors and that beryllium copper bit and all that. I think that's where I sort of departed with you, Dick. I didn't use that business with the spring and all. I did it a little different. I think I used a plastic reed screw, if I'm not mistaken, in some way. I don't remember. Gee. That amplifier became, what happened with that amplifier? I traded the amplifier eventually with somebody. I don't remember what, but I remember he took it for, in fact, he took it for EME. That, wow. In New York. Yeah. Gee, I can't. Guy by the name of Jack. Now, what was his call? He was a big EME guy, because he came from upstate New York, and he brought me something that I switched with him over.
Yeah, there were quite a few guys on EME up in New York State. The other part of the circuit that you may have disagreed with is the grid circuit. The grid circuit was kind of spooky. It had two miniature series variable capacitors adjusting the grid drive. And that was a bit spooky, and it was a rare part. A small Johnson butterfly capacitor was one of them. And the smarter guys made a flapper capacitor for the grid loading network. Those two series capacitors, if you didn't lay it out just right, people had trouble making the grid circuit hit resonance. Back to you, Mel.
I remember I had some problems with that. Odds and ends with that amplifier tool. I got it working the way I wanted it, but eventually it did come out. Yeah, well, it did come out pretty well, but I didn't lay it out exactly the way you laid it out, the case and everything. I wound up building it more as a small rack mounted setup with the power supply on the bottom and the head amplifier above it, but more of a classic design, Dick, with more metering and everything, over.
Yeah, my version weighs 3 pounds, and it's very easy with a handle on the side to transport it, not counting the power supply. The power supply is a biggie, of course. But it's a 3-pound amplifier that can put out 700 watts in those days, legally with 1,000 watts in. And if you're willing to raise the screen voltage, you can put out 1,500 watts peak envelope power out of that amplifier. Kronk Tonum F9FT was getting 2,000 watts out of his strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier by using lots of voltage and lots of air and lots of drive. And his tube supposedly would survive. It's a testament for how rugged those 4CX250B tubes are. And if I had it all to do over again, there's certain modifications I would have made. I would have made the plate circuit a little bit shorter so more people didn't have trouble hitting resonance. I would have made the grid circuit a little bit easier to reproduce. In those days, I was using what I had available, and I cared about performance. I wasn't as concerned about easy reproducibility. And when I built that thing in 1971, I never expected that many people would be duplicating it. And if you guys ran into an awful lot of trouble, if they didn't have the right kind of a bleeder resistor on the screen grid power supply, man alive, could they run into trouble. Because under certain loading and tuning conditions, a 4CX250B will supply negative screen current. It will pump up your power supply on the screen grid, back bias your rectifying diodes, the screen voltage goes sky high, the tube draws a ridiculous amount of current, it'll blow every fuse in the house. You think it has run away with oscillation. It's simply a bias network run away, not RF oscillation at all. But the one guy who did do a 432 meteor scatter did it in that mode of operation. He's probably getting 2,000 watts out of the tube. That was K0LER. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, K2KEY here. You know, it reminds me. The original design, I saw of a similar amplifier. In fact, I think I started to build it that way, was one with a tube. There was a tube called, I think, the 6360. No. No. Yeah, 6360, Dick. Which was a, I think, a 500-watt amplifier for 2 meters. And I think it was, how the heck did they put that together? They also used something, I forgot about the tuning system. I think that the 6360, what did that, came out before the 4CX250R? Or was it a replacement for it, over?
We don't have the right number yet. 6360 is a small dual grid, a dual tetra tube, I think, 9-pin. There is a 61, there's a 61-something or other tube model, 6188, can't think of the model number now, which is also somewhat popular in those days, but nowhere easy to get a hold of as a 4CX250Bs. In those days, the FAA was pulling 4CX250Bs out of their FAA transmitters every couple of months, even though the tubes were brand new, and those tubes were hitting the surplus market at extremely nice prices. There are times you could buy tubes in very good shape for $5 a copy and $10 a copy. Now back to you, Mel.
Would that tube have been a 8560 you're talking about?
No, 8560 doesn't sound like the right number. There's a bunch of sixes and ones and eights somewhere in the model number of the tube, but I'm having trouble remembering it right now. Back to you, Mel.
For some reason, I remember that tube. 6360. Yeah, it was 6360. Well, what the heck was its application? I think it was some kind of a... wasn't a ceramic type. It was a tube that came out that time. It was like... it was a double... gee, was it a double triode or something? I remember it was used in the original version of the of a amplifier similar to yours, but it was built, I think, by W1AW, I think, that, and then they suggested, I think, that there was another way to go ahead and build a single two-meter amplifier using a single... single 4X150, Dick, over.
Yeah, the K2RIW amplifier, as some people called it, in the United Kingdom, you were only allowed to run one tube. I think you were allowed to run either 150 watts max or 500 watts max input. So the K2RIW, the one tube version, many of the people in the United Kingdom call them K called it the K1 amplifier, meaning K2's got two tubes and K1's got one tube. 8877 is another one of those great big forced air-cooled ceramic external anode things by RCA. 8877, that was a great big high-power tube. And there is a 61, 66 or something like that. There was another tube with sixes in it that was kind of popular, quite a bit smaller. The 8877, I think, ran something like 1,200 watts plate dissipation. And a number of moon bouncers are using that tube today. And I think that tube is now like $1,500 a copy. Not very much cheaper, even if you buy it from Svetlana. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. No, yes, no doubt. I know those tubes came hard to come by, and that's it. Okay. Anyhow, my favorite, basically... My favorite was the 4CX 250Bs, and before that, my let's see, my exciter. It was a homebrew exciter. I used a 2E26 stick. Over.
Yep. Somewhat familiar with that tube. And I'm trying to think, what did I drive it with? Oh, in my case, I drove it with a 4X150 as tripler service, another strip line, the amplifier tripler that was in. Ham Radio Magazine, February 1970, is what I drove mine with. So I had more than enough drive. That thing could easily put out 75 watts in the tripling mode. And that I drove on 2 meters with a solid-state amplifier with RCA overlay transistors in it. And I could flip back and forth between a kilowatt of output, actually 700 watts of output, kilowatt input, or 1 watt of output, by simply flipping off the plate supply on the 4CX250B, because I had a great big dropping resistor on the screen grid. The screen would draw more current, the voltage would drop down to a nice low number, and the amplifier would put out 1 watt. So if I wanted to talk locally, I just flipped off the power supply and talked with 1 watt. And if I want to talk to somebody far away, with the power supply on, out came 700 watts. And I'm looking forward to the day when I put that all back together again. 432 was a real fun band for me. And in those days, I had a reasonably yucky single sideband transmitter, a KLM Echo 70. And the KLM Echo 70, when it's putting out 10 watts of sideband on 432, which eventually was driving my amplifier, it also had a little bit of FM modulation along with the sideband. So it didn't put out the cleanest sounding sideband. There was a modification for that that came along later on to put a better voltage regulator in the right spot. I never did find out about that and never did do it. But that was the exciter that on sideband talked to K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles away for 4 solid years. Every Tuesday night we were testing the propagation over that 400 mile path on 432. And that was kind of a fun project. And I now know that I was running a ridiculously high noise figure. Boy, would we have had a much nicer circuit between us if my 8 decibels or whatever it was of noise figure was down to half dB of noise figure. What a difference that would have made. And I ran that way for multiple years with all that extra loss in those phasing harness cables, the water getting into the foam-filled phasing lines. K2KEY, make sure you wait. K2LIW. We got about 3 minutes left, Mel.
Hey, now I put my mind in order, and I remember the tube I was thinking of as 829, and 829B was a very popular tube that came out, I don't know, somewhere, I think, as in World War II, as a VHF high-powered amplifier tube. And then what happened was the ceramic tubes, you know, like, for instance, the 4X150, it had a number on it. That's what I was thinking about. It was a 7034, the tube. The 4CX250B were known as the 7203, I believe, tubes. And then they had another one, a 75, I think, 80. I think that was... I think they were all the same, but they had different numbers. Was it different manufacturers or whatever? But the original one was a bottle. It was a glass bottle. And it was 829, the 829D, which was, I guess, too high for something to do with high-powered VHF. World War II, that tube came out. I don't remember exactly what its application was, but it was one of the first of the higher power amplifiers that came out for 2 meters. All right, whatever. Nice to reminisce about this stuff. A lot of years went by. Okay, catch up with you guys next week. 73s, and I'll start digging into these emails again. I'll get a chance. And the Tetros, I could say, of those days were a lot of fun to play with. The 829, I think that was a 5894, if I'm not mistaken. All right, talk to you next week. Take care. Have a great week. This is K2KEY. Back to you.
Yep, 7203 was the four-digit number for the RCA 4CX250B. Another one of those nice air-cooled tubes was 7650. The 7650 had full power output ratings up to, as I remember, something like 1100 megacycles. And because it went to 1100, everyone said, well, we'll just stretch it a little bit to 1296. That tube fell off like a rock between 1100 and 1296. Had very little power output at 1296. And yet the 4X150 also had a number beginning with 7. And I'll have to look that up one of these days. And there's another popular tube beginning with a 6. But 8877, 7650, 7203, 4CX250B, all very good tubes. You guys have been listening to TechNet number 1269 of the series that began in 1982 in September, 27 and a fraction years ago. Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. Be kind to each other, and see you guys later. K2LAW clear.
You're right, Dick. 7034 was the 4X150, and the 7203 was the 4CX250B. Now, I remember RCA numbers, right? 783, Dick. you got a good memory. Take care.
It's slowly coming back, some of these things. We have to keep reviewing them from time to time, Mel. Otherwise, all this history will be lost. Good night, Mrs. Fastenau, wherever you are. See you guys.
K2KUY, AC2AE.
K2AE, go ahead real quick because we're going to lose the repeater, over.
Hey, I just wanted to ask a quick question. I didn't want to interrupt the TechNet for this kind of a question. It had nothing to do with technical. I'm being a new ham since January. I just wanted to know if there was any forbidden subjects that were forbidden from ham radio. I haven't found anything in Part 97. I'm referring to religion, politics, and so forth. Anything that you can shed some light on me for?
Really, the only thing is, of course, anything to do in that would, I guess, incite a riot or whatever. Or you can't, use ham radio for financial gains and things. Discuss a product that you want to sell that you're in business and want to advertise it. You're not actually permitted to do that. In other words, you can't use ham radio through a working for a company and they like
from the
stuff and stuff
with
their communications for profit.
Net tonight at 8:30.
Some of the things get a little tinkling now.